we are human too, and we're experiencing the pressure, and I don't think that we have to hide it. I think it's even creating more intimacy because they see that you are afraid too, and you're not afraid to say that you're afraid, but you're not too afraid to talk about it. And that's the good opportunity to talk about many fears.
Welcome to the IPA podcast. For those of you who have been listeners to the past 40 episodes of this podcast series, you know that we've been focusing on analysts who bring their clinical skills to venues outside of the consulting room, hence the name psychoanalysis on and off the couch. Given that we are all facing together a crisis of unfathomable proportions, we're going to be changing the focus of our podcast. We are going to be interviewing psychoanalysts from all corners of the globe to discuss with them how their local communities are coping with this situation, how their clinical work has been affected by this situation, and also how the internal worlds of both the analyst and the patient have been impacted by this virus, as it impacts both our real fears and our imaginary fears. We're going to encounter not only uncertainty and fear, but we're also going to learn great wisdom, gifted empathy, and hope. We'll be maintaining the title of this podcast, both as a testament to our past work and as a placeholder for our future work. I hope you find these conversations both informative and sustaining. Feel free to write comments on our webpage, IPAoffthecouch.org. Thank you. Welcome to today's podcast. I'm Harvey Schwartz, and my guest today is Shahrzad Hashemi. Shahrzad Hashemi is a psychoanalytic psychotherapist and an advanced candidate at the Comprehensive Program for Psychoanalytic Psychotherapy at Hamava Institute in Tehran. She is also the editorial assistant of the open access journal Psychoanalytic Discourse. In addition to her private practice, Shahrzad has been involved in many psychoanalytically informed activities in hospitals and in schools. For longtime listeners to this podcast, you'll recall my conversation with Shahrzad and her colleague Rosa Famini last year when they described their clinical work with children and teachers in the Tehran school system. This conversation reflects the changes we're all going through. This conversation, we will discuss what life is like in Tehran and specifically how it affects her clinical work. They have been under quarantine. By the time this episode airs, it will be for 8 weeks. This episode was recorded on March 29th and will air a week later. As you can tell, this conversation, the focus is limited to clinical work. I hope you find it as intriguing as I do. Shahrzad, welcome back to the podcast. It's so nice to be in touch again. Shahrzad, it was last year that you and I and Rosa Famini spoke together about the fascinating work you were both doing in the Tehran school system, working with children and teachers and parents, and focusing on affect awareness and affect regulation. And it was quite instructive and quite important. Here we are this many months later, living in a different world. And I wanted to catch up with you because you in Tehran are way ahead of us in terms of your quarantine. You're going into, I believe, your 7th week of quarantine. When I first learned that, I was startled. Naively startled, but startled, because we were just at the time in our 2 week point, and I couldn't imagine 6 and 7 weeks, but it's to be all of our futures. Tell us what it's like to be so isolated for so long, and then we can talk a bit about how it's impacted your clinical work.
Well, hello to you and everyone hearing us, and thank you for having me in this podcast. First of all, before telling anything, I want to express my deepest gratitude to all the health workers who have dedicated their lives to save lives around the world and in our country. I think this is pure love. And of course, I would like to offer my sincere condolences to all the people grieving. We're just so sorry for all the innocent lives and their remaining loved ones in pain. Just let me tell you about these 7 weeks. Of course, you know, at first, we tend to deny it. Of course, me, myself, I was just seeing patients. And I think that this too shall pass. It's not that much big. But it just started to get serious. I was panicked for about 2 days. I thought just my heart could stop at that time. And after that, we chose to practice social distancing. And we've been practicing it for these 7 weeks. Of course, we're just in Nowruz. I don't know whether you know it or not. This is the Persian New Year. And the holiday is about 2 weeks. People tend to visit each other, wear new clothes. And this is getting more awkward in Nowruz, and, you know, sitting sure. in your home, not visiting anyone. And if you visited, you're a potential murderer, just all of a sudden. That was like that.
And does it change over time as you go week by week by week? You know, you're ahead of us in the curve. And so I want to kind of sort of look into the future.
Yes, sure. It has been changing me, of course. At first, I think even I and other people I know were panicked and very anxious. We used to obsessively check the news and the contradicting news with all the fake news there. And, you know, after about, for me, it just took 5 days, 6 days, maybe a week to just think that this is not going to work. This is going to ruin my life. So I have to stop it. I have to find another routine to survive. So I just shifted, I just canceled my work in in-person mode. I shifted to online mode. And then each week after week, I was bored to somehow, but the anxiety decreased. And I began to make new routines for me to feel at home in my home.
Mm-hmm.
That was like that.
Has the entire therapeutic community been in touch with each other? Have they all agreed to switch from in-person to online? How did that transition go?
Well, yes. We decided mainly together, of course, mainly all the people I know, because it was getting serious. And I thought we were role models. You know, all the patients look at us and we had to take it serious, you know. Along with the work that we were doing as a professional, that was therapy, we were humans. And I think that was a social responsibility to show the people that this is serious, that we are too, you know, using social distancing. So, yes, most of those are practicing online or using telephone psychotherapy from that time. And we are in touch with each other. We have Zoom sessions together. We talk to each other about patients, about how we're feeling. We talk to our supervisors and analysts, but just online or by the telephone.
So the community has pulled together. That's
yes,
something
of
we're
course.
Seeing here in the States and in the IPA as well. Can you share with us what it's been like clinically? What it's been like for patients? One of the unique aspects of this that so many people have commented on is that, unlike many other traumas that patients bring to us, this is a calamity we are sharing. We don't share it necessarily identically, but in some ways, we're all in danger of dying. Tell us what that's been like for you.
Yes, of course. I think we have to talk about it in two parallel lines. the thoughts and the feelings that I was having as a person and as a professional. Of course, I cannot just make it separate, but we have to make it separate so that we can talk about it. You know, that was hard, not seeing all the people that we used to see. I think this is a loss for all the analysts as well. We're losing seeing our patients, our offices, the feeling that you're there with them physically. So I think it's another loss, along with all the people who are, I think, losing their jobs. We're just losing this aspect of our job, and this is a loss. And along with that, I think in telephone sessions or online sessions, I find myself more struggling because I think that we're missing something in the session, that physical presence. So I have to try more and more to show them that I'm there, maybe to show myself, I don't know. So that's, you know, I have to put more energy into it. Plus that I am frightened, of course, not like some other people that are just stopping life, but I'm afraid also. And I think, you know, one of my patients even asked me, aren't you just afraid? And I told her, of course I'm afraid. Of course, it's normal to be afraid. I think this is another aspect that we have to maybe focus on it. This is normal to panic, to be fearful about. But I just told them that the contents, our stories, our narratives about this fear are different. It's just like any time else that the patients tend to talk about fearing death. And I told them, okay, all of us love our lives. We don't want to die, but our narratives are different. What are yours? And another aspect is that we are experiencing the pressure ourselves. We are under that pressure, and we have to take care of ourselves. It's just like that we have children to take care of. We have to be there. We have to be calm as long as it's possible. But on the other ground, we are human too, and we're experiencing the pressure, and I don't think that we have to hide it. I think it's even creating more intimacy because they see that you are afraid too, and you're not afraid to say that you're afraid, but mm-hmm. you're not too afraid to talk about it. And that's the good opportunity to talk about many fears.
So you're saying it becomes part of the process. It becomes a vehicle. The intimacy and the sharedness becomes a vehicle to explore new things in new ways, you're saying, yes?
Yes, of course. It's been hard, but it's just paving the ground for some underlying fears to come to the surface. Of course, I think we should be cautious about giving interpretations in this particular.
Well, that's a very important thing you just said. Can you say more about that? You feel you should be hesitant about giving interpretations. One of the things that people have spoken of is therapists, that there is an inclination to be literal and concrete, given obviously mm-hmm. the literal and concrete dangers we're operating under. And that may be just what it is. For this time, we are, like you say, more human than otherwise in this shared space. And yet, the question is also, can it be used as a vehicle to refine metaphor? Is that a gift that we can give patients to, even in the midst of this literal crisis, to maintain the place of metaphor and symbolization? And you're sort of bringing up that tension between the two.
Yes, of course. And I think it's very difficult to remain in the intermediate zone between the two, you know, extremes.
Yes, it is.
And, you know, I was just talking to my supervisor, and she was telling me that try to be more supportive, but keep in mind that this patient is also telling her or his own story. And after sessions, if you see that they're just getting worse, you can think that maybe not just being supportive is enough, so that you can just begin to confront some things little by little, so that think what happens. So I think, yeah, we have to be more cautious in this time. It's just like re-traumatizing your patients by giving, you know, that immediate harsh interpretations, because we know all the stories and we can formulate to some extent, of course, not all the things. Mm-hmm. That's all.
Are there patients you can share with us that will demonstrate some of these tensions that you're describing?
Yes, of course. You know, first of all, I lost three of my patients, and that was sad. You know,
they refused. You lost them. Oh, they didn't die. They just lost.
Yeah, of course not.
Oh, sorry. Okay.
No, it's okay. Yeah, it's a weird time. No, they refuse to shift to this modality. Uh-huh. I'm going to just follow them up, of course, after the holidays, because we didn't know that it's going to just continue this long. And we were not scheduling for it. We were just thinking, okay, we're canceling or shifting to telephone or online session for 2 weeks. Then we have 2 weeks holiday and we're going to go back to normal, former life. And it changed. So
sure.
That was one part of it. For some, it was weird to hear that. And I was just trying to give them an opportunity to try that. I call it a trial session and we would talk about it. I had two patients in mind that I think that those experiences were just interesting. One of them was this young man I used to see on a weekly basis for about, I think, 1 year and a half. He used to be silent most of the time, 40 minutes. And I was just telling myself, why is he coming? Even I asked him, why are you coming? What do you want? And it was nothing. And I was just left with all the questions. Then then I have to change to phone analysis. So I told him that this is the new routine and he refused. And I offered him the trial session. We had two sessions. And in the second session, it was like, he was just smoking cigarettes and not talking again. And he was bored and telling me, okay, can I go? And I was just asking, what is it that it is so hard for you to talk? And he said that I want to be present. This is not going to work. This is not presence. Presence for me is just physical presence. All the other forms are fake. And, you know, I was just thinking that maybe that was why he was just coming to visit me, just seeing me physically and then go, because that was kind of presence that he wanted. And that was interesting, you know, to know that.
Did he end up staying or leaving treatment?
No. He couldn't understand it. He was just like, you know, agitated, frightened, anxious. It was very hard for him to bear it. And I think that, okay, so we can just put it on hold. Of course, I told all of them, you just wanted this to stop, that we can just put it on hold. And mm-hmm. whenever we come back, I will just have your appointments there and I will call you and invite you to come back. So that was what he decided. He decided to cancel.
All right.
But for those who accepted this change more willingly, there were just some fruitful sessions. I can say even more than before, because, you know, this pressure made some underlying fears come to the surface, as I mentioned before. I was seeing this young woman for about, you know, 2 years now, and she's mostly anxious about losing her loved ones. And of course, at this time, she was particularly very frightened. And that was the one asked me, just, aren't you afraid? And I said that, okay, yeah, mm-hmm. I'm afraid. Yeah. And this is normal to be afraid. But you used to tell me that you're afraid about losing them. What is it exactly that frightens you? Because we're all afraid, but the contents are different. What are yours? Tell me just the story of yours, if you want, actually. And she was like that, okay, you know that I'm not afraid of dying myself. I'm more afraid of losing my loved ones. But after she hesitated and told me that, to be honest with you, I'm more afraid that after they die, they're going to come back and don't let me leave, because they envy me maybe, or they want to take a revenge from me that I'm alive and they're dead. And that is very frightening. And that was a good session. I thought, okay, that's not the death that you're afraid. That's the return of the death. That's something else. So we have to talk about it.
Well, that brings up so many issues about people's, you could call it superstitious beliefs. You could call it religious beliefs. Mm. You could call it primitive beliefs. There are different phrases for it, but that's a whole other twist, that the patient per se wasn't afraid of dying, but was afraid of the loved ones coming back and attacking her after they're dead.
Yes, of course. Yes. You know, because the pressure is too high, we all tend to regress. I think I myself regress to my previous, you know, mode of life. I think it's going to be hard. So they regress also. And we have to just keep curious, be supportive, and listen. And the most important part for me was to remain curious. Although, as you mentioned, there is an external threat for all of us. It doesn't mean that we have to be concrete. We have to be supportive, but not concrete. We have our minds with ourselves in the sessions, but we can just stop them from giving immediate interpretations. But,
you know, an interesting thing to consider is that while the patient you mentioned might have the freedom to verbalize that primitive fear built around projection, but maybe many of us who aren't that regressed still have that capacity to have those fears inside us. But it takes someone like that to be able to say it, to help us identify that. Maybe that lurks in us as well.
She can say it. And yes, I was just thinking that, wow, that's good that you can just say it. Yeah. I totally agree with you.
Yeah.
It's, you know, it's somehow in the analytic community, it's just shameful to be that much primitive, but we all have it. We all regress. We all have our own problems. And maybe this is the title of being a psychotherapist or an analyst makes it harder even to accept these parts. I know it's paradoxical, but I think it's there.
So we can learn from patients like that about ourselves too. Shahrzad, your family, your patients, your community, you've been through this for so long. What have you found helpful to sustain you and your community through this?
Well, I think that's a very critical question. I think for I and the people in here, I cannot talk on behalf of all the people, but to some extent, I think is just living in the Middle East. I think in here, we just used to life being unpredictable. Floods, earthquakes, wars, constant threat of war, hard economic pressures. So, you know, it's as if, of course, this outbreak is kind of different, but we're just used to it. Apart from that, it's something that people, you know, make jokes about it. After each tragedy in here, there is an outbreak of just jokes.
Yeah.
And a lot of funny videos, and people try to dance to these sad events and adversities as a coping strategy. But for me, myself, it was just, I have my own psychic shelters, movies, series, music. I think good voices can just save us from this. Along with, of course, keeping just in touch with my therapist, supervisor, family, friends, and of course my patients, you know, helping them help us. And this is the thing that I love about it, and it's sustaining me even more than before. Of course, it's hard, but it's just helping me. And after all, I think it's something that I had to accept it because I couldn't do anything about that. I just tried to change my lifestyle to adapt to this new form of untasty life because I don't know how much we're in it.
Yes.
So that was my experience.
You say it so beautifully. We are sustained by good voices. And I do want to let you know that your voice strikes me, and I'm sure many listeners, as one of the good voices. There is a gracefulness to your descriptions, both in words and in spirit, the way you describe your clinical encounters, and even how you describe your life, how you made the transition from the initial panic to finding new routines that would sustain you And I want to thank you for sharing that with us. Thank you for sharing your thoughtful devotion and immersion in this work, which undoubtedly is of enormous benefit and sustaining for your patients. And I wish you all the best.
Thank you so much for giving me the opportunity to share ideas with you. I really hope you and all the world will be safe till the end of this corona period. Take care. We are all really together in this. We can only endure this through love, loving ourselves and each other. So keep safe and keep loving.
Thank you. Thank you for listening. If I may, I'd like to ask you to help us publicize our podcast by rating us on iTunes or simply sharing it with a friend. You can also visit our webpage, ipaoffthecouch.org, where you can both subscribe and also add your comments. I'd also like to acknowledge the lovely rendition of Beethoven's Opus 18th String Quartet by the Allegri String Quartet on the Vivat label.